Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
You are watching the Deadfoot Diver Podcast with Kurt the Deadfoot Diver.
Welcome to the Deadfoot Diver Podcast, where we talk about everything diving, tech diving, and especially the benefits of diving with disabilities. Today, I'm very pleased to have on world-famous diving author Simon Pridmore. How's it going,
Thank
Simon?
Goodness.
It's awesome to have you on. I loved your books. Actually, the first book of yours that I happened to read was the Scuba Confidential one, because I was thinking about getting back into being an instructor again.
And actually that
gave me a lot of laughs reading or listening to that book and hearing you, because a lot of the stories, it's like, oh yeah, I forgot about that type of stuff.
Well, that was the idea, right?
So, it's an awesome book. It's really good for anybody. If you're looking to become a professional dive master or instructor, you definitely want to check out Simon's book on that, because it's definitely an excellent value and you'll get a lot of good laughs out of it too as well. So tell me, how did you first get involved in scuba diving?
It was a long time ago. I was working in the Sultanate of Oman, which is just kind of what would we say? We'd say west of India and east of Saudi Arabia, and there's a little country there. And I was working as a teacher, and it's so hot that we used to work in the morning, and then in the afternoon we'd go down to the beach. And I tried windsurfing, and the windsurfing didn't really go very well. And I looked at the divers going out, and the divers would go out every afternoon and they all looked like they were having a great time. So I thought, well, I could try that. You know, I'd been swimming all my life. I'd spent a lot of my life overseas, born in the UK, but spent my whole life traveling with my parents. And that was out. I tried, I went along, I did the course, signed up for the course. Course took weeks and weeks. It was a British Tobacco Club course. And we started off in the pool for, must have been 3-4 weeks. And then we got into the ocean. Then we had to do 10 qualifying dives and everything else. And it took a long time. But after that, you were ready. You know, you were ready to go out on your own. And that's how I started. And that was what, back in 1981. So a long time ago. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And when they had scuba courses were a lot longer back then, because I was certified in 91. And like now you just go in and do e-learning and go to your pool session and then do your
waters and you're done. You've just described why I decided to write my books. Because, you know, essentially I know from working in the industry for so long that divers, when they qualify as divers, they have open water diver or whatever they want to call it. And they're not really ready to scuba dive on their own or even with an equally qualified partner. They're not ready. So that's why I wrote the books. That's exactly what drove me.
That's awesome. So from there, when you started diving, how did you decide to get into writing?
That's another story. The writing came a lot later. And so from Oman, I was there for a couple of years, and then I went to Hong Kong and started working for the Hong Kong government here. And that was a full-time proper job. That was something that occupied all my time. And I, the only chance I had to dive was with a local club every now and then. And I'd actually, in Oman, because I was a teacher there, I'd started teaching, not actually in the water, but the guys who ran the club figured that they had somebody who was used to standing up in a classroom doing all the, you know, all the talking. Yeah, exactly. And they didn't like that part of the deal. They were quite happy teaching people in the water. And then they found somebody who could actually do the, you know, so I qualified, I got my ticket. And the next thing they said was, right, you're teaching the next course. That's it. And I said, well, you know, they said, as long, you know, I said, what if I say the wrong thing? You know, what if I advise them poorly, you know? And the guy said, it's okay. He said, I'll come into the class with you and I'll stand at the back. And, you know, if you say anything, then I'll chip in. And he came in, he was there to start the first class. And 5 minutes later, he turned around, walked out the door and never came back again. And that was it. But, you know, that was a good introduction to teaching. Of course, they did all the important stuff, which was in the water. The qualified instructors did all that. Anyway, so I'm back, you know, I go to Hong Kong and I do a bit of fun diving here and there and dive with the club and everything else. And then, as you probably know, the Hong Kong changed. Hong Kong was due to be handed over by the UK, which was a colonial power at the time, to China and handed back to China, if you like. And I knew that I would be out of a job. And I thought, what do I want to do next? And scuba diving was it. That's something I enjoyed. I thought, well, maybe I can make a life out of my hobby. And so I then went to a local dive shop and signed up to become a dive master first and then a scuba diving instructor second. And for the last few years of my life in Hong Kong, I was in the office in the daytime and the evening, weekends, I was teaching diving. And that was the next step, if you like. And then once that, you know, once Hong Kong was handed over and I needed something to do, I thought, well, the best thing I can do is actually start my own business. And luckily I had the money to be able to do that. And I went to Guam in Micronesia and I set up a dive shop in Guam. And now we're in 1996. And I set the dive shop down. Seven years. And yeah. And what I'd done as part of my, when I was in Hong Kong, the guy I was working with who had a dive shop in Hong Kong.
And how long did you own the dive shop for?
Learned about technical diving, what people were doing over in Florida and the northeast of the United States. And we were very interested by that. So we headed off to Australia to do our training with an IANTD instructor trainer there, a guy named Rob Kaysen. And he brought us into that. We came back to Hong Kong and I started teaching nitrox classes in Hong Kong. And one of the reasons I chose Guam as the destination was because we had deep water offshore and easy access to gas.
Yep.
And there was nobody there teaching technical diving. I was, you know, I was it. So that's what the dive center did. It was quite unique. We set up a dive shop that was completely focused on mixed gas diving, on technical diving, on rebreathers and things like that. And this was 96, and in Asia that was quite early. You know, that we were several years behind you guys in the States. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, we had the Draeger. We had the Draeger first, the semi-closed unit. And then shortly after I got
For rebreathers, though, even in 1996,
how many
rebreather systems did you guys work with back then?
Supporting me in the dive shop and old friends and everything else. And I went over to the UK. Yeah. And then we had the two units. We had the Buddy Inspiration and we had the Draeger. And that was the beginning. That would be 97, I suppose, late 97, early 98, something like that. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So well, what made you decide to get into technical diving? Because I mean, technical diving, you have to have a pretty totally different mindset, let's say.
And then working out how you could do it as safely as possible so you could repeat it and reduce the risk in diving. Because I could see that there were areas of scuba. Let me go back a step. You know, recreational diving, sport diving essentially created rules to prevent you going beyond a certain depth and a certain time, and thou shalt not do that. But what if you wanted to do that? Why, you know, was that possible? And the information that the technical divers were making, that were acquiring and then making available, told you that, well, if you wanted to go down longer, if you wanted to use a different gas, if you wanted to use multiple gases, if you wanted to go deeper, then this was the way that you should proceed. And they never said no. They said, this is how. And I really liked that mindset. Of course, there were still limits, but the limits were physiological rather than just random. And I like that concept a lot. That really attracted me. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You're right. Rebreathers, back then, especially, there was a lot higher fatality rate than there is now with the rebreathers. So tell me about some of the challenges that you guys had when you were teaching, started out with rebreathers and teaching them.
You might have qualms about getting into rebreather diving, but we didn't know how little we knew. If we knew something, we thought, okay, that's good. We know that. And then we would discover, unfortunately, in some instances, tragically, by trial and error. We had I still remember I did a rebreather, a semi-closed rebreather course in Thailand, and we were on ex-Australian Navy units, and the instructor was on open circuit because we only had two units. And he would come out on open circuit. We would go out. We would do some skills. We'd get used to the machines. And this is, we do several hours underwater doing this training. And later on in the course, he ran low on gas. So he returned to the beach and to change tanks, basically. And he left the two of us out there. And we're sitting there and just sort of staring at each other, waiting for him to come back. And suddenly the other diver who I'm with just turns over and passes out. And we're in a few meters of water. And I get him to the surface. We lift his head above the water level as much as I can, get the mouthpiece out of his mouth, inflate both of us and everything else. And luckily he comes to. He takes a breath, he comes to, he's fine. It wasn't the end. And by then the instructor had come back, and together we got him back to the beach. And what it turned out, of course, is that there was a blockage in the gas feed, and he was slowly, you know, over the last few minutes, he'd been breathing less and less oxygen with each breath, and we were shallow, and that was that. He'd just gone hypoxic, and flipped out. And this is really early days, and we, you know, the concept that the the narrow feed that was taking the gas, the nitrox, it was into the rebreather could get blocked that way, and that you would not notice that it got blocked.
Wow.
And that would be it. And he wasn't, you know, and the fact that hypoxia could render you unconscious just like that, just by like snapping your fingers. These are things that we just weren't aware of. And it sounds impossibly naive now, but that's how it was. We just didn't know. Mm-hmm. Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've had multiple guys on here who dove with the rebreathers back in the 90s. Yeah, like, I remember John Chatterton
for the Britannic, right?
Telling me
I remember that.
Five failures or something the first weekend he was trying to do, where he had to do bailouts the first weekend he was trying a rebreather unit. And then he literally took it home, had it pulled apart on his table, kitchen table, fixed it, and his next dive on it was on the Britannic. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's definitely a lot more dangerous. I'm actually going to try a rebreather next month, so I'm pretty excited to try it.
Right.
Just to see it. So I'm looking forward to that. I don't know if I'm going to continue on that path. Yes. Probably
and
not.
There's a lot more going on
of the rebreathers. And not only that, it does concern me with the extra training involved and stuff like that and my disabilities, because I only have one eye.
Uh-huh.
And I find that, you know, I already have a lot of stuff to monitor with one eye when I'm doing a dive and trying to enjoy the dive.
Yeah.
For sure. So let's talk a bit about more about some of your books. Like, you have done quite a bit of a technical
if we're talking about
writing,
the writing
in that aspect,
so if we're talking about the writing,
tell me,
I think the
of all the things that you have done
first,
with your
a book called
technical writing and stuff,
and technically speaking,
which,
essentially
what do you like to focus on more?
Sport,
is there a certain area that you like to focus
how it came
on
about,
when
why
you're
it came about, who the people were,
doing
who
your
did
technical
it, what the concepts were at the time, and why it came about, the question that you know referred to earlier on. And when I was writing that, I was talking to a lot of people who were involved at the time as well, and making sure I got all, you know, it was very controversial. And I wanted to write it in such a way that I paid due respect to the people who were involved at that time. And what came up from the research really was that in those days, we made a lot of mistakes. We got things wrong. We didn't know. I mean, the example of that rebreather course is perfect, you know. But everybody made those mistakes. We just didn't know. But we fixed it. Every so often, as you were teaching, you know, somebody would have a problem. Everybody would dive onto this problem to try to figure out what had gone wrong, what they could have done instead, and that's how the sport grew. And we didn't get everything perfect, but we identified the major mistakes, the major areas in which you could fail, and the outcome might be tragic. We identified all that, and we designed the course materials, the technical diving course materials, accordingly. And we knew, so you know, in the books that was how to do it right, but we also knew how to do it wrong. And as I was writing, I realized that people coming into technical diving today don't know the wrong bit. They don't, they can see what we recommend and what the instructors recommend and everything else. But what they can't see is all the things we attempted that were wrong, that didn't work. And so, having written the volume one, the history of it, if you like, I then wrote volume two, which came out just recently. And that essentially goes back to the beginning and talks about the concepts which we follow now and why we follow them and how to get into diving, how to get into rebreather diving. There's a chapter you should probably read before you go and do your tryout on the rebreather. Have a little look. I don't know. It's probably chapter 3 or 4 or something of volume 2, and it's exactly what you're doing now. Exactly that. It's the things to think about. I think you should get that now. If you've got a couple of hours, you know, yeah, do that. Okay, cool. Just have a look. But it's that's it. That's the history. The first book is the history, and the second book is my take on technical diving based on those days, essentially.
I actually just got a copy of that one a while ago. I've been going through, so I will definitely make sure I go through that rebreather section again before I do my tryout on it.
Michael, technically speaking, was a really
good book. I enjoyed it.
I waited
because he gave a lot of history stuff and talked about Michael Munduno and pioneers of diving, which was really good. I really enjoyed that one, and it's good to get a background of how technical diving started.
He was right at the center of things. He was right there, and he should have written this book, but by that time he then got involved in the online magazine and In Depth, the thing that he's been doing for the last few years, and he just ran out of time. He did a couple of articles about it for magazines, a kind of brief run through of how it all came about. But I spoke to him and I said, look, if you're not going to do it, should I do it? And he gave me a blessing, which was very, you know, I was very grateful for, because it, you know, really, he and others, you know, were a much better position to do this book. But if they're not going to do it, I had to be done. Somebody had to do it. We had to get it out there, you know, because it was a moment in, I mean, we're a really niche market. We are a niche area, you know, part of the human experience. But I thought that particular era, when scuba diving changed forever, really, I thought that needed recording. That's why I did it. Good. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Huge. Okay.
Yeah, Michael unfortunately just passed away a few weeks ago. I was lucky enough. I got to know him over the last year. He was on my podcast when I first started. So I was very happy to get to meet him. He was actually a big influence on my diving and stuff. In fact, I still have a copy of the Bent magazine. Because we were going to meet up at some point and he was going to sign it for me from Aquacore. So,
you did. Nice.
Yeah. And I mean, even when you started technical diving, back then, there was a lot of, I mean, even Nitrox was bad.
Cool. Very cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I dove in 96. I got certified in 96. I actually took a course from Dick Ratowski up here. And yeah, I was lucky enough to get taught by the Godfather. I'm like, I have a very short four number digit for my Nitrox cert. So he's it's nice when I go to fill out the logs because I look at my friends.
See, I mean, if you go back to
numbers are like 30 digits long now because Nitrox has taken off so much.
It seemed impossible that would happen. But there
I mean, I guess the one thing that surprised me, especially when I got back into diving, when I was in Cozumel the first time, we're going out on a snorkeling trip and we're looking at the dive boat and it had who all was on Nitrox and on air and on like four dive boats that were packed.
As you do,
there were I think two people on air
a day.
The rest of them, everybody else is diving Nitrox.
The old days when we were diving with air, by the time you got to your fifth dive of the day, you didn't have an awful lot of no deco time left. And now with Nitrox, it's transformed. Sure. Yeah, the scientists will tell you there's no rationale for that. But you know, the scientists don't know everything. They'll tell you there's no practicality. Yes, but it's absolutely true. In the evenings, in the old days when we would be doing four or five air dives a day, in the evening by 8 o'clock everybody's gone to bed, and now they're up and they're playing cards or they're doing the photographs and everything, and that everybody's up.
Yeah, it's really good that way. It's a lot safer. I mean, you're a lot less tired on Nitrox as well after diving, I find.
Sure.
No, because all you have to do is talk to thousands of divers. Yep.
I mean, that's good. It's a good question. And everybody has their stories. Mine would not really.
It's definitely centered on a much safer way to dive for sure.
As such.
So tell me, since you are a very experienced technical instructor, you must have some funny stories about stuff that happened with students, because everybody does.
Completely overestimating my abilities.
What's one of your funniest stories?
Somebody who has a problem. That definitely happened, where you would think you could take two or three relatively new divers down on a deep dive, and nothing would go wrong, or if anything went wrong, you could fix it and figure it out. And that kind of, you know, that happened. I had a I don't know if you know Guam, but the famous dive in Guam is the Blue Hole. It's a vertical tunnel in the reef top that goes down to the wall, opens out on the wall, and it's an exciting dive. And at the right time of day, it's a cathedral of light in there. It's fabulous, fabulous dive. But it's deep, and it's a lot deeper than you normally go. And I've had times there when I've confidently taken three or four divers in, and they are strung out behind, and you look behind and you say, and somebody has just gone out of lost control of where their head is. There's this, as I said, this enormous cathedral of light around them, and they've just spaced out completely. And then you've got to gather up all the divers like a sheepdog gathers sheep and try and get everybody out of there. And they're staring at you in the face, and there's nothing going on behind behind their mask. They're having a ball, but they don't know they're having a ball, and they don't know how deep they are, and they don't know what's going on. They had a couple of those. And I remember one where, you know, skin of my teeth, I got them out of there and got them back on the boat. And I'm sitting there and just puzzling over how I must not do this again. I will not do this dive again with, you know, with this number of people and all the rest of it, and just bashing myself on the head. And one of the divers who you know, probably the one who was most spaced out during the dive came over to me and said, "That was great. Let's do it again. Let's do it all over again." And I'm thinking, I never want to do that again. Just no idea. Crazy, crazy. Oh man. And of course, I mean, the narc doesn't leave you. You know, the narc is still there. No. Uh-huh. Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. Some of it is that you are more aware. I think
he was narc that bad.
You are more aware of how you're feeling, and therefore you identify the narcosis.
The
biggest problem is that
absolutely people are not. I have found since I started diving again last year that because I've been doing progressively more deeper dives again this year.
Just
me and I forget, but the narcosis seems to hit me a lot harder now at
56
than it does than it did in my 20s.
Guys on the seats are solving all the problems of the world, and it seems so easy to solve all, you know, solve all the difficulties. And by morning, what were we talking about? And the same thing, the guy, you know, things people do on alcohol and diving deep on a nitrogen heavy mix, that's same thing.
Yeah.
No, yeah, exactly. Well, this is true. Now, John was an early proponent of deep video on dives, right? But we didn't have the technology. So what we did and what we went through.
I remember John Chatterton saying he was doing a dive on the Doria Richie Kohler.
Kind of grateful for that.
And they went down to put the line down, and Richie apparently did the line up, got it all tied up, then totally undid it. And then tied it back up again.
Oh.
Because he was so narked and had no recollection of it at all, except for the fact that John got it on video.
Yeah. No, when they're ready. When they're ready. If they're not ready, then no camera. If they're not able to manage a dive without a camera, then they're not ready to dive with the camera. But that's a really hard, I mean, it's a hard thing to do. And you know, some of them bought cameras before they do their course.
So there's another thing. What is your opinion with teaching students with cameras? Because a lot of people have a lot of instructors have different opinions on this.
No, that's right.
Yeah,
that's how it is. But now, as you know, the camera is the thing. The camera is the most important part of it all. And we, you know, I think we all went through phases where we would have a cameraman come along and record.
Yeah, I know that I've seen people do crazy stuff with cameras because they get distracted, you don't pay attention.
We'll record the dive for you.
One of my dive buddies, awesome diver, Wayne, hasn't got a camera in, but Wayne's got a camera in. Oh man, look out, because he doesn't pay attention.
Photographs and everything else, but that nowadays that's not enough. Not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a good way to die. Yeah. No, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, everybody has a camera. Yeah, I have a rule that if I book, I don't know if you know, change I work any with, of my gear up at all, I go and I do like Guam named I Tim do Rock. Three or four dives and no cameras.
Two of us have put out
just even with
got
me.
More dive guides than
yeah
I have.
Because but, I not only that like I said I'm blind in my one together. Eye so I have enough and going on as it is. I don't need to be dealing with a camera to add on to it.
To Komodo and Southeast Indonesia, which includes
the Alor. Tell me what you have. Do you have any new books coming out besides the Technically Speaking Tour? You're working on any other projects?
I've done the text, and he's now putting the text and the photographs together, and that's his part of the job. And we should have that out, relatively soon. Before Christmas would be nice. Lots and lots of people are diving Komodo these days, and that would be the major draw. But the diving in other areas of Southeast Indonesia, especially the Banda Sea, is exceptional, and it's becoming more accessible over the years. And that's what people are looking for. I think people are looking for unspoiled reefs. People are looking for reefs with plenty of marine life. They're looking for more and more remote places, and the liverboards are taking them, and that's it. And it's just a guide to where you should go and what you'll see when you get there, and that's it. And then next year, I'll finish book six of the scuba series. The one you mentioned, Scuba Confidential, the first one you saw. That's now five books, and next year will be the sixth book. And I sat years ago after I'd done the Scuba Confidential book. I was sitting at a lunch table with non-divers, and I said I'm going to do another book, and they said, haven't you already done a book on diving? And and they said, and I said, well, yeah. And they said, and what's this second book going to be about? And I said, well, it's going to be about diving too. And they said, you can say that much about diving? And I said, well, I'm trying hard.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, it's funny though. It's funny. I always think that I've done the last one. And then new topics come up and new ideas come up and all the rest of it. And I think, well, okay. A lot of the stuff gets trailed in magazines. I do the magazine article. And then if the magazine article, I do the magazine article, and the magazine article is limited by space, you know, I've got a whatever word count I have. And if I think I could say more about this, or there is more to say, or I want to make other points, then it goes in the, you know, in the folder marked next book. And that's over the years, that's how it keeps going. I don't know. I don't know. Let's see. I don't know. I think there's a book somewhere that covers the period from maybe 2000, early 2000s to present day, and how things have changed, how things have developed, how the diving world has changed in that period. But that's what we're talking about. So 20 years, and maybe it's, I don't think I'm ready for that yet. Maybe in five, 6 years' time. Maybe
that's
it'll
really
be clearer.
Cool. So are then, you going to do any more topic, technical, you know, diving books coming up?
The pathway will be long enough to justify a book on how things have changed. Because we're in a transition period. And I don't know where the transition period is going to end up. But maybe then. Maybe that would be the next technical diving book. Maybe that would be it. I think that's fine. I'm absolutely happy with that. So this is just my opinion, you understand, but in the beginning, the mainstream agencies didn't want to know. They really didn't want to. They had a really good thing going on.
Since we're on the topic of technical diving here, spoiling that with rebreathers, what's your opinion of
everybody's making good business out of
organizations that are mainly sport diving that have now embraced rebreathers
government
and pushing it through into a compact course?
Sticking their nose in because the diving safety record was not. It was fading. You know, there were problems with diving safety record, and they decided to step in. And that didn't happen, but they were really worried that would happen. And that's what generated the new training agencies and the technical training agencies, the specialists. And then the major agencies decided, especially as far as Nitrox was concerned, but that they'd accept Nitrox anyway. You know, they join in with that. And some of the technical agencies, one in particular, decided that they would then broaden their spectrum and cover all ranges of diving. And that training agency has managed to conquer a little bit the mainstream. But there are still technically specific agencies around, and they have very capable people running them and are doing exceptionally well, and they're happy with the niche, with remaining in the niche. But at the same time, there are now some extremely qualified people, well-qualified people in all the major agencies. You know, PADI, SSI, all the agencies have some really good people. And what they have is the money and the manpower and the research background and everything else to make strides that the small agencies cannot. They're able to push in directions that the smaller agencies can't. And that's great. I think everybody benefits. It really is a question of, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. It really is a question of that. And I think the more work that's done, the more that that organizations like Dan do, and it's all beneficial. The more people involved, the better. That's my view. Yeah. 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 I did, but yeah, I in the early days I did some cave diving. I did plenty of wrecks around the world.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, when it comes to tech diving, I think it's awesome how it's expanded. I think it's awesome how it's much more accepted, and you're not blacklisted per se because you're doing tech diving anymore.
in the late 90s,
because let's face it, all those pioneer guys took a lot of heat over some of their research and their diving that they did back then.
We were just several hops on the island hopper away from Majuro, and then from Majuro
we take the plane. Where is your favorite place? I know you've done a lot of stuff in Guam, but do you do cave diving at all, or
fabulous
wreck diving, or
and it's so accessible. You know, the advent of technical diving opened up the wrecks of Bikini because because they were beyond accepted sport.
Bikini,
but they're not super deep. You know, you're not diving to ridiculous depths, and you're able to get some nice long bottom times on the ships. It's just fabulous diving. Fabulous. Yeah, there you go. There you go. There you go. His operation is exceptional. There's a piece I wrote about technical diving tourism, which is in one of the books. Maybe it's in that book too. But what Pete is doing is really, he's covering all the bases when he does these trips. He's making sure the equipment is there and the gases are there and the backup is there and everything else. And he's got this taped. He does an excellent job. And when you think about it, that was something that we never had back in the old days. We really were at the if you wanted to do an
expedition. Yeah, I've heard that. I had Pete Mesley on here money, who runs trips time, over. To,
effort. There were very few people who had the time to do it. But now if you look at what Pete's doing, he's taking all the stress out of it. You can do technical diving exploration, if you like, just like you book a holiday. Just like you, you know, he's taken all the effort out of it, which is wonderful. Really, really amazing. Sure. Well, that, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very good. He does a couple of those a year, I think. And yeah, fantastic. And Truck is still great wreck diving, exceptional wreck diving. And the people at Blue Lagoon who Pete works with, they know their wrecks. The guides are fabulous. We were there, where were we there? Last June, in June 24, we were there for a week. And yeah, and it was good, as good as ever. Really nice.
Yeah.
Oh, probably 14, 15.
I really want to go do a trip to Truck Lagoon with him.
Yeah.
That's one of my bucket list eyes for sure, is Truck Lagoon. And if I do it, I want to do it with Pete.
It's not the famous, most famous, but it's beautiful. Beautiful wreck. And yeah, and there's still, you know, there's... as you know, there's a couple that are leaking oil now. There's a couple... The masts have come down. There's a little bit of, you know, the sea is taking its toll. And at some point, unfortunately, in the future, the wrecks will disappear. They will be, you know, the sea will take them over. But we're now at the point where.
How many dives did you do in a weekend truck?
Around the wrecks is as good as it's ever been. They really are little oases in the ocean.
And what's your favorite wreck?
And you may not be able to get the kind of penetrations that you used to do because of collapsing metal hull, you know, parts of the structure collapsing. But around the wreck, there's a lot of marine life. There's always something to see. There's plenty of stuff. It's nice. Go. No. No, they. Well, it's the they are. When we were there in June, there was a team from Japan who were there for a couple of weeks, and what they are doing is recovering human parts from the wrecks and taking them back to Japan for burial and for whatever they do with it. But and this is very respectfully done. It's been going on for decades, and every so often they find more bones in other wrecks and then the team comes out again and they.
Oh, I definitely want to go.
I think it's a government sponsored program.
Do you still see a lot of bones on the wrecks and truck?
It's been going on quite a while, and that's. I mean,
they pretty well clean those off.
You know, it really is. It's a great thing for them to do and to and timely because yes, if they're going to do that, they have to do it now. And I think you may be aware of some ships in the South China Sea which were dived. They were also wrecks, and unfortunately pirate metal. Yeah, you're nodding, and you've pirates have basically come along and disappeared these wrecks. They've just gone. They've been lifted off the seabed and just gone, and that's absolutely tragic. In truck, there's been a lot more yeah, they treat the wrecks as they should.
Yeah.
Hmm. Mm. No, that's wrong. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is awesome. And it's good that they're removing the bones and putting them away, because there's nothing more that bothers me than seeing a diver on a wreck taking some video down there, looking around. Next thing you know, they're picking up human remains and stuff, which is not cool. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to dive those places, then fine. Respect it and don't disturb the human remains. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today, Simon. It has been amazing talking to you. I've really enjoyed it. I look forward to your new books that are coming out. And thanks, everybody, for joining me on the Deadfoot Diver podcast today. And remember, grab an adventure and live.